So we have another guest classic episode today, guys. This is something that really stuck with me, and I think it sticks with all of us. You know, you hear so much about serial killers. They're often romanticized here in the U.S. in fiction and in documentaries. But how many serial killers are there? How many have yet to be apprehended? That's the question we asked today, and it goes to some disturbing places, you know?
Yeah, the first thing you have to do to be able to catch a serial killer is to identify the work of a serial killer, which is sometimes not as easy as television and film may make you think it is.
That's right. I mean, we are really lucky to live in an era where a lot of film and television producers do kind of understand this a little more than they may have in the past. And we have series like Mindhunter that does do a pretty damn good job of getting inside this whole process. So in this episode, we're joined by Christian Sager, excellent comic book writer and former host of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, in general, all around good dude, to talk about some cold cases and some of the inherent challenges in tracking serial killers and figuring out if, in fact, they've been caught at all.
And the spooky thing is, folks, we don't know who is listening to this episode right now. You'll see what we mean.
And quick note here, you may hear a few names or individual killers in this episode that have been apprehended since we created this episode in October of 2015.
From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. If you've heard the intro music, hopefully that means you're in the right place. I'm Ben.
And I'm Noel.
And most importantly, you're you and you're here, which makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Now, this episode has a lot of stuff going on, and hopefully you'll find it as interesting as we do. But before we get to the dark heart of today's topic, we have some very big news. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Frederick has returned.
That is right. I have returned, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome. Welcome, Matt Frederick.
Well, thank you, Nolsef.
No, it is you, though, right? You're not a vampire dressed up as our friend Matt.
I cannot confirm nor deny that.
Are you a replicant, mayhaps?
That is, perhaps. I am so sleep-deprived at this moment. Seriously, 2.5 hours last night, and I tried very hard to get some sleep last night, and it did not happen. So, perhaps this is an inkling of Matt Frederick.
No, Matt, is that because vampires don't actually sleep at night? Yeah, I'm an armchair biologist. Or is it because of something else?
Well, it's the little thing we talked about before, you know, babies, babies everywhere.
They do tend to make sounds at odd hours.
Yes, they do. And I have found out that my wife sleeps right through those sounds, and I do
must be nice,
not.
Huh?
Yeah, I do not. But I also am terrified to wear earplugs or something just in case something does go wrong or I need to hear that sound. Mm-hmm. So at this point, I'm just kind of living with it. You know, it's all good, though.
Do you have one of those newfangled video baby monitors, or are you at that stage yet?
I have one. Uh-huh. It's not a newfangled one. It's literally a security camera that can broadcast essentially over Bluetooth. A couple other things. So I'm going to use that.
What's the frequency so I can watch your baby?
You know what, Christian Sager, guest on our show today? I'm going to get to that later. I'm not even going to address that comment right now.
No, Christian raises like a good point. Because when you say security camera, it does sound like you think your baby's going to steal or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, look. I'm not going to say anything against Mr. I'm just going to say his name. I don't know. Have I said his name before on here?
I don't know that you've spoken his name.
I don't think I'm going to.
Okay.
I have a son.
His name's just
he exists.
Yeah.
Mr. Mister. Which is a mosquito service in Atlanta. I don't know if anybody knows that.
No. Oh, I get it. Like a mist, a pesticide mist.
Yep.
Nice. There we go. We have also, as you could tell, buried the lead a little bit because we do have a fourth person on the show today who just got introduced to you, but we're going to do it again because we love introducing this guy. You'll remember him from some earlier episodes that we have done. Our friend and colleague, co-host of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, writer of numerous things here at How Stuff Works, One more time for Christian Sager.
Oh, thank
Hello.
You. I'm so happy to be here on this momentous occasion, and I didn't realize that in the stuff they don't want you to know that they were Nazi vampires.
Sometimes.
Nazi replicant vampires.
Nazi replicant vampires. Right. Well, I'm glad to be here to learn the deep, dark secret.
There's another lead you're burying slightly, is that with, you know, no explanation, last week's episode was... Matt was back.
Oh, that's a very good point.
He came back.
It was a John Titor moment.
We didn't discuss it. And just, you know, just to shed a little light on that, that was an episode we'd recorded right before Matt took his leave. Mm-hmm. And it's the first in this series that we're working on. So made sense to drop that
scenes.
One.
One of the last things I want to say before we get into the meat of this is a huge thank you to super producer Noel Brownsif for taking over and just being awesome show. Thank you, Ben, for basically helming everything while I was gone, from the videos to, you know, the podcast to everything. Thank you, Christian, for making sure the How Stuff Works headquarters, you know, is in order.
I know you did everything do your job. I could.
Every single thing.
Yeah, everything. Everything's fine.
You realize it sounds a little like an award speech, right?
Okay, so I also want to thank Academy. You know.
I also
want to
thank Mr.
Mr. Mister for having those signs that I noticed and stayed in my head until I came on this podcast.
So
also Rockstar Energy Drink for keeping me awake when I have to be. Thank you.
A little native advertising.
There you go. You like that?
Zing.
Give me some free energy drinks, please.
That's where the money comes from, people. Stuff they don't want you to know. Right. That's right. The vampire Nazis drink Monster Energy drinks. Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing. It's replaced blood. Not just in Matt's system, not just in Matt's circulatory system, but in that of Nazi replicant vampires.
Yeah,
sorry,
right,
Noel,
I gotta get this
around
straight.
The world. So, guys, we're several minutes into the beginning of our show.
And off the rails.
It's good that we started out with some levity and some friends returning and well-met, because today we are going into a dark subject. We're returning to one. You will recall, listeners, that if you're listening to these podcasts in order, previously we started the – can we get like a previously? Who's got a good voice?
Previously on stuff they don't want you to know.
Boy, that was great, you guys. So
professionals.
We did this – topic earlier that people had asked us about. You had asked us over Twitter, Facebook, YouTube comments to cover the so-called Highway of Tears. And while we were looking into that in this series with another friend of the show, Scott Benjamin, Christian, we started talking off air about other disturbing things related to serial killers. And we found, I guess, worse than disturbing. We found some horrifying things about serial killers on the loose.
Yeah, I'll put it this way. So we've also done a video about this subject, which I'm assuming is going to be live by the time this podcast is released.
It will correspond, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Perfect. So you can go watch that video. And here's a little behind the scenes for you. We're very jocular, as you've just heard. We went in to go shoot that episode and just could not muster the humor that we normally have, because it's a very dark topic and it really kind of brought the tone down. So that the video is like the dark sister to this podcast, probably. Mm-hmm. But I think too, I mean, we're going to talk about a lot of the same subject today. I also think that it's kind of fascinating though, in its own way, in that, true crime and serial killers, and especially uncaught serial killers, the stories behind them, I think, they encapsulate something about American culture. I can't put my finger on it, but they encapsulate something about it, these like moments in time that are kind of perfect. Have you ever read, Norman Mailer's The Executioner's Song before?
Oh, wow. Yeah. A long time ago.
No.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just this great, true crime book. It's, it's nonfiction, actually. I'm sure he, you know, put some hyperbole in there.
Sure.
It's a huge book. But about a guy responsible for murder on death row, and just a great way to capture kind of this particular moment in American history. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way about some of these stories that we're about to tell today, although they're not only American, are they?
Right, absolutely. We've also seen similar things such as The Devil in the White City, right?
Yeah, that's another one.
During the World Fair. Mm-hmm. the way that John Wayne Gacy fundamentally altered the Western perception of clowns.
Right.
And
right.
is probably responsible for a lot of chorophobia, I think is the word for it. Chorophobia.
So I have an aside that'll maybe help us out here. I have a friend who is currently staying in a clown motel in the desert. I believe it's in Arizona for 1 month.
What is a clown motel?
Yeah, it's a clown-themed motel in the middle of the desert. He raised money on Kickstarter to do this. And
okay.
He's staying there and writing about his experiences. And part of the Kickstarter, the rewards, was that he has to dress up like a clown every once in a while in his room and just sit there.
I mean, we've all done that, right, guys?
Yeah, sure. I have one last aside on this.
Sure.
My wife showed me a picture 2 weeks ago of one of her best friends who was hanging out at a bar because she was moving away from Atlanta.
Okay.
And it was like their goodbye party.
Yeah.
There was a gentleman drinking alone at the bar, and all that he wanted to talk about was this picture he had on his cell phone. An old picture that he'd taken, a picture of, mm-hmm. of him as a kid and John Wayne Gacy at his birthday party making balloons for him.
Oh, I remember you telling me about this, or maybe you shared it.
I think she maybe shared it. I don't know.
That's what it was. It was Chandler.
Okay.
Our coworker
Chandler was there
and he told me about it. Yeah.
Wow.
Very strange.
And it's also strange when you consider that what we're going to examine now will be the likelihood of a serial killer uncaught, running free range, somewhere in your town, somewhere in your neck of the woods. And we'll take a look at the statistics and the facts here. You've probably had this thought before, ladies and gentlemen, guys, Noel, Matt, Christian. Have you ever been in a crowd and thought, you know, I wonder what the worst thing someone has done in this crowd is? Because it's true that it's more difficult to get away with murder nowadays than it was, you know, when our parents or grandparents were our age. But it's a paranoid thought. The good news is that serial killers, as we are going to find, are relatively rare birds in the great aviary of crime, right? But Matt, what is a serial killer?
A serial killer, as defined by the FBI's crime classification manual, it essentially says that they have to kill in several places, so at least three places, during different events, and there has to be a cooling off period in between these deaths, these killings.
Okay, and that's a commonly accepted definition.
At least, yes, that is. When the FBI says, hey, we're going to define this crime as this, then generally I go, okay, FBI.
You know what's something that I hadn't thought about until now, and I think could bear some further research from maybe another episode, is that the FBI is defining that. Serial killer feels like a very American phenomenon, right? I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it happens in plenty of other countries. But I wonder how it's defined in other cultures, especially since we're going by that classification.
Right, yeah, and the FBI, you'll often hear it called serial murdering or something. There were some closely related types of homicide that we looked at in the video, right, that you have to distinguish between.
Yeah, well, right, you've got mass murders, and those are basically the reason why they're different from serial killers is because that's when you have four or more victims, but it's in one specific time and location, right? Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, this is something we're familiar with recently because we've had kind of a spat of them. Mm-hmm. Then there's also spree killers, which are a little different. And the FBI refers to these as killers that tend to keep killing over a period of days or weeks, but they're in different locations, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have the cooling off period. So unlike a serial killer who would maybe, you know, take like a month between killing or maybe longer, there isn't that kind of pattern.
Right. Mm. These people may continue killing until they are stopped, literally. There's another thing here that we could add while we're defining what makes a serial killer, and that is there's often some sort of psychological aspect to the crime, some sort of exploration of an emotional trauma, for instance, some sort of ritualized thing that is based on a pre-existing mental condition, right? So people are reliving certain moments, or people are responding to a pathological problem with a parent in childhood or something like that. But that's this is what we have when we're loosely defining these things. And the phrase serial killer comes to us first from a book called The Complete Detective, published in 1950. But going back to this conversation about serial killers and the very American nature of it, which I agree, many cultures across the world associate serial killers with the U.S. and the only other big one being Jack the Ripper.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But the actual idea of a serial murderer was coined in 1931 in Germany in reference to a killer named Peter Kirpten.
You know, I think the media in the U.S. has certainly distorted maybe our view of what a serial killer looks like, what they sound like.
Ooh, I agree.
You know, how they function, what their problems are psychologically. And one of the big things that I noticed the FBI kept reiterating is that serial killers don't all look a same way. They do not all follow a pattern. There are so many things that you have to look at when you're trying to profile somebody like this.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is the thing that's actually scary about thinking about uncaught serial killers, right, is the idea that in our entertainment that we almost fetishize this serial killer entertainment culture, right? Mm-hmm. Think about like shows like Hannibal, right? So the whole show is about one profiler who's profiling all these different serial killers that just happen to all happen around Baltimore, Maryland, right?
Right.
I love that show. But it does, you know, stuff like that and a lot of police procedurals do sort of not glorify, but create a somewhat fantasy version of what this is like. Mm-hmm. And there's always an assumption that there's like one specific incident, like that grandma wasn't nice to them when they were 10 or, you know, what's Hannibal Lecter's incident? Something with his sister, right?
Well, okay, spoiler alert officially. I don't know if we want to do a sound cue for that or something, but he was forced to participate in acts of cannibalism
as
a child.
Okay.
And that's.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it. Right. I think that's an excellent point because it's one of the myths, and there is this mythology about serial killers. But we have to be clear, a serial murderer doesn't necessarily have to have some physiological injury or a neurological injury to their brain, like Otis Toole, right? Mm. It can instead be a lack of empathy. It could be part of the ingredients. There have been, of course, you know, there's that famous triumvirate, that was proposed earlier that suggested a relationship between, or suggested there were three red flags to see someone growing up to become, I think, a pyromaniac, a sexual deviant, and possibly a serial killer, which were bedwetting to late age, torturing animals.
Yeah.
And what was the third one?
The torturing animals is the one I always remember. I don't know what the third one is.
Fire. Was it arson?
Driving a Honda Odyssey?
Christian.
That's scary. Don't say that.
I'm not allowed to comment on that, actually. But here's our point. We have a hard time as a society, at least in the States, profiling what a serial killer is because they can be very different. We're not looking at the root of a perpetrator or a criminal. We're looking at the work that they have done. We're looking at the crimes they have committed. And that makes it very, very difficult to find the source of it, which is why one of the biggest myths about serial killers is that they get caught all the time.
Right. Yeah. And I think that too, like that's part of the myth that entertainment spreads as well as,
right.
And no offense to any criminal profilers out there, but I don't think that it works like it does on TV, right? Like
where, yeah, they want to get caught kind of. So they play a little game
and they all have like a little theme about how they do it, you know, like as we're about to find out, that's the MO isn't always the same, first
right,
of all.
Right, right.
But also just that, like, it's not so easy to nail down exactly what kind of person this is so that you can narrow down the field of potential suspects.
Right. So just as a warning for everyone who is listening to the podcast, we are entering the part of the show where we're going to talk about some grisly details. And we're doing this because this is true crime, which is something that interests all of us associated with this. This is also an opportunity to shed some light on some things that are misportrayed. And also, these are real monsters. These are the closest thing to genuine monsters, you know, and there's a great folkloric supposition or theory that reports of werewolves and stuff were really these older cultures, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to understand mm-hmm. serial killers.
Yeah, but why would someone do this?
Right. So we have several examples of serial killers who are currently not apprehended.
So let's go ahead and get started with number one. And I'm going to throw this to Christian because I know you did a lot of research on this fellow.
Yeah, I am.
This person.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, right? Is that it's often right. assumed that serial killers are male.
Mm-hmm.
This particular one is known as the New Bedford Highway Killer. And I chose to look deeper into this one because I'm from the Boston area and New Bedford's pretty close to Boston, Massachusetts. And one of my good friends grew up there, actually, and I've spent some time there. So I had a bit of an idea of the locale in my head when I was reading this. It wasn't just like reading text in research, you know what I mean? Like I had an idea of what the culture was like there. So in 1988, somewhere between 9 and 11 women, they don't know if all of them were victims of this particular killer, were murdered between April and September in New Bedford. And if you're not familiar, New Bedford is the town where Herman Melville set Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. So it's a seaside town in Massachusetts. Used to have a strong fishing culture, mm-hmm. Industry, and it fell on hard times. So all of these bodies were dumped by the side of various highways leading outside of New Bedford, I-95, Route 140, and Route 6. And all of these women were thought of as sex workers, and they all were thought of as having drug problems. Now, I will say, like, in some of the research, there were parents of these victims who disputed that.
Okay.
I was telling you guys off air that my buddy who grew up in this town said, you know, I'm not all that surprised. There's like a particular type of person who like hangs out downtown, and they're just assumed to be involved in drugs or the sex trade or something like that, and they're just largely ignored by the rest of the community. Okay. So he wasn't all that surprised that they were sort of labeled that way, and it's easy, I think, for that idea to sort of fall through the cracks too, mm-hmm. right? And say like, just slap that on and say, well, of course, that's why they got killed.
Right. And then it's also from the killer's perspective, less likely to draw attention.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing that was really interesting about the actual finding of the bodies mm-hmm. is that, I mean, this New Bedford is a fairly populated area. Most of these bodies were badly decayed and already exposed to animals and the elements by the time they were found. And we're talking about on the side of the highway, not like in the forest, you know.
Okay.
So the problem here was that there was a lack of physical evidence for the police to really work with. Mm-hmm. They just had these bodies, and they didn't really have, you know, I mean, they'd been exposed for quite some time, so there wasn't a lot to work with there. So what went on was in 1988, like I said, New Bedford was on hard times. In Massachusetts, it's generally acknowledged as kind of, you know, being a little bit shady. It's a place where you can get, coke and heroin. And it was regarded, you know, as having a bit of a heroin problem. There was a local clinic there at the time that estimated that it was treating at least 400 heroin addicts a day.
Jesus Christ.
So that's second to Boston in the state. You know, again, like that helps paint a picture, but it also gives you an idea of sort of like why the police, I think, gravitated to this idea of just like, okay, so they're sex workers and they're drug addicts. So mm-hmm. that's how they're getting nabbed, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other problem here is that many of the original investigators that were involved either have retired or moved away, or they've like moved up the ranks in the Massachusetts police force, and they're in command positions now that can't be abandoned so that they can follow up on leads on this case.
So like they're a chief now, and they because of that, they can't go back to decades old cases.
Yeah. And honestly, like when I was looking into sort of the broader range of uncaught serial killers, I think that that's a fairly common problem with finding these guys decades later, you know, is that, like the other one I'll talk about, in this episode had sort of similar thing where, you know, people had retired, moved away, or they just, you know, had moved on to bigger positions. And unfortunately, these cases, they're not forgotten. They're still there, but they're not being worked. I guess it's like, you know, from how entertainment is terming it, it would be a cold case, right?
So this is just me thinking inside the podcast room, and I know this might be horrible, but that fact also kind of makes me a bit suspicious of the law enforcement. And I'm not saying you know, as a blanket way of law enforcement in those areas, but I don't know if in the wildest of theories, if someone was involved in the law enforcement then, you know, if they've moved up and they are no longer involved in such things, or perhaps, I don't know, are able to cover up some actions.
You know, yeah, it does make sense. And these allegations of potential cover-ups, right? It's something, it's a trope we see often in different films.
Well, yeah, again, is it just media muddying my perception?
Not necessarily, because there are cases such as the Atlanta child murders from 79 to 81, which is, as listeners know, the town where we record this show. There was an Atlanta native named Wayne Williams who was convicted for, murders. The child murders were grisly and included almost 30 kids, you know, and at this point, there are many people who believe that Wayne Williams was set up or was a murderer who had something attributed. And another way this corruption could happen would be if you consider the story of Henry Lee Lucas, who is suspected, and I hope hear my air quotations here, guys, suspected of hundreds of murders. But there's also a question whether law enforcement was, you know, goading him into confessing things or incentivizing him to get that off the books.
Yeah.
So this is an aside, but let me formulate something here.
Okay.
On Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we did an episode about the psychology of necrophilia. And
wow.
It was an intense episode, but it was also really interesting to dive into the research. And surprisingly, there's a ton of research out there.
Okay.
You know, if you want to learn more, go listen to that episode of Robert and I talking about people having sex with dead bodies. But there is in necrophilia, it's understood that as a mental disorder, it's something that develops when people have the opportunity to take part in it due to their career. So there's like a good chunk of necrophiliacs that are associated with it and only perform those acts because, you know, they work in a hospital or perhaps they work in a morgue or something like that. They come into contact with dead bodies and they have the opportunity. So, all right, establishing that, moving back to where we are on uncaught serial killers, you know, the police are also in a situation in which they are often working with dead bodies.
That's interesting, because
I'm not saying police, all police are necrophiliacs. I'm not saying they're serial killers. I'm just saying that if there was the potential for a mental disorder, the career puts them in a situation where they have the opportunity to indulge in such fantasies.
Well, that's an opportunity. You know, it reminds me of another statistic I read where apparently, and this was only conducted with men, I think, apparently male shoe store employees have a higher likelihood of a foot fetish.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Which maybe that also speaks to opportunism. Sure. But of course, you know, we have a lot of law enforcement that listens to this show and has written into us before about corruption in a police force or in a military organization. I think at a certain point, you know, there's a calculation that comes with power and with opportunity. And people who haven't seen The Wire, I know everyone gets tired of people trying to proselytize for The Wire, but it does provide a very good look at the internal political machinations. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily, when we say corruption or cover up, we're not necessarily saying, you know, we're not saying that Lieutenant Scott Benjamin is a police officer just so he can continue poisoning the elderly in ambulances. but we're saying that.
Right. That's a plot of a bad, like, procedural TV show.
Right. But yeah. What Chicago is much more, PD. Right. What's much yeah. more possible is that someone wants their record to look good to affect their chances of promotion.
Well, yeah. And so get back to this case, actually, there's a really good example of that very kind of common everyday, political slash, law enforcement corruption that happened in this case that led to it being unsolved. So the victims, again, you know, let me just remind you, there were 9 to 11 women. They were all strangled. That was the only kind of common thing in the MO. But none of the research that I could find listed any methods of murder beyond that, like whether they were strangled with a rope or with hands, or there was just not a lot listed. Which made me think maybe the police never released the details. They're holding on to that information. And again, remember, this happened in a pretty short span of time.
Right.
So they might not have wanted to release the information.
Well, yeah. So anyone calling in would have to have, or if anyone had details beyond some of the very, very general, perhaps that's someone you could look at.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they're strangled. They were always found nude, abandoned on the side of the highway. And 2 of the victims' bodies were never found. So that's why there's that 9 to 11 thing. They don't know what happened to these 2 particular women.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some really fascinating leads in this case. Again, it's unsolved, but, this is what we know. There's a guy named Tony DeGrazia in the area who had a history of sexual assault with prostitutes, specifically that, you know, kind of area, culture of prostitution and drug use that was in New Bedford at the time. However, there was no evidence to link him to this case. And in fact, he committed suicide in 1990. If I remember correctly from the research, one of his relatives speculated that the suicide was probably brought on by all the attention that was focused on him from this case.
Huh.
So there's no evidence to link him to this other than that he just happened to be a guy who, you know, hung around, I guess, with that crowd, but also was a known sort of violent offender.
I see.
The other possible theory, and this is something that I ran by my friend who lived in New Bedford at the time, is that the killer was also a killer that was known as the Lisbon Ripper that was operating in Portugal in the 1990s. And the reason for this is that New Bedford has a very large Portuguese community.
Hmm.
So the idea was that this guy could potentially have been flying back and forth between the continents and performing various murders. And then, you know, I guess the cooling down period would be him going to a different location.
I see.
And that's one speculation as to why they were never able to get him. This is the deep one, and this is the one that has a little bit of corruption connected to it. The other guy was a lawyer in the area named Kenneth Ponte, and he was actually indicted for the murder of one of the women that was involved, one of the victims. But his case ended up being dropped due to a lack of evidence. Again, and both the investigators in the case and the surviving family members of the victim say that they don't think it was him. However, here's how things played out with this guy over the course of a couple of years. Ponte, the reason why he was a suspect was that he also knew some of the victims, and he actually served as one of their attorneys.
Hmm.
However, he had a personal feud going on with the local district attorney, a guy named Ron Pina. The way that I saw it in several reports that I read for this episode, apparently it stemmed from the fact that their mothers were neighbors, and they didn't like each other. And therefore, there's just this kind of family feud that had gone back for a while. So Ron Pina is the district attorney. He gets a special grand jury to indict Ponte. So that's where the indictment came down from.
Huh.
When Pina loses his election as a special prosecutor, they have to drop the charges because there's no evidence.
Wow.
So, again, Ponte, you know, there's no evidence. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. They can't actually connect him to the case. And there were also, like, a lot of reports about jurisdictional issues between the state police, local police, and the feds. So, again, that's another thing that we see in entertainment crime stories all the time, right? But as far as the research for this case, that was an actual thing that held up them being able to really nail down evidence in this case.
And at this point, the murders remain unsolved.
They do. Yeah. In fact, Ponte, while having drug problems and being disbarred and was even later caught shoplifting. They were never able to find anything. In 2007, the police went back to his old house and dug up the front of the house because they thought there might be something there. Mm-hmm. They didn't find anything. And he died in 2010. So that's all the New Bedford police, Massachusetts State Police, and the FBI had for this case, you know, at least as far as we know publicly. Obviously, you know, as we were saying earlier, they must have had other information that they just didn't release. But this person remains uncaught, whoever committed these crimes.
You know, what's fascinating about that is it shows another possibility that I first ran into with the Zodiac killings. I was not involved, just to go on record there. I'm not old enough.
We believe you.
Thanks, Matt. So the one of the suppositions was that the murders stopped because one of the suspects was incarcerated on a different charge and died in prison or died somewhere else as a result.
Right.
So it is completely possible, you know, that obviously not Ponte, probably not.
Yeah, I mean, there was like a good 20 years in between the end of these murders and him passing away where nobody was killed in the area. That doesn't mean that, you know, maybe there was potential evidence that could have connected him to the case, but they never found it.
And let's look at another one that is a little bit different, because this person was actually apprehended and did go to jail. But wait, that's not the end of the story. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about Pedro Alonso Lopez, also known as the Monster of the Andes. He is suspected of killing more than 350 girls, primarily in Ecuador, Colombia, and Peru. Originally, authorities didn't believe his story. 350 dead children is a lot.
Well, yeah, because he was in jail for something else, right? And then he was talking to an officer who was, like, dressed up as an inmate, mm-hmm. and basically boasting about all of these girls that he had killed. And he was naming off like 100 in Peru, 100 mm-hmm. over here mm-hmm. in Colombia, 100 in Ecuador. And they, you know, if you hear a grandiose story like that, that is awful.
Right.
I don't think you believe him on the first account.
Right. And they didn't either until he led police to a mass grave of 53 victims in Ecuador, all girls between 9 to 12 years old. And here's a strange thing. Alonso Lopez, though, was, when he was in prison, it wasn't his first brush with a judicial system. When indigenous villagers in Peru caught him trying to abduct children, they buried him up to his neck, and were pouring honey on him and preparing to have him die by having ants consume him.
Yeah.
Until a Western white missionary saw him, prevented this horrible pagan practice, and said that she would take him to the cops. She drove him to the border and let him go. That was his first brush with the consequences of these deranged actions. So here's his time frame. He was first active 69 through 1980 or so. And while he was in prison, it was deemed too costly and complicated to have him on trial in both Colombia and Peru. So Peruvian authorities in August of 1994 deport him to Colombia, where he was found insane and held in a mental ward until 1998, when he was released to the public. The last that we have heard of Pedro Alonso Lopez is in 2002, when Interpol released an advisory for his arrest on suspicion of another homicide. And he has, again, primarily killed female children, also male. As of 2015, the year we recorded this, Lopez would be 67 years old if he remains alive. And again, it sounds, this guy is a little bit unique because you can read a purported interview with him, which I wasn't able to verify to my ideal standards, but
it
seems pretty. It seems pretty legitimate, and
I'm trying to verify that stuff as well right now, and I agree. I can't verify it, but the way the way some of the things are written, and then knowing what we already know about him, I would agree with you that
right.
it's probably him.
And the interviewer is real,
yeah,
obviously.
Absolutely.
But so here's the thing that this leaves us with. If he's 67 years old, he most likely is not going to be in the best of shape. Not everyone is Sean Connery, right? So this would make us think that maybe he is too frail, right?
We hope.
We hope. I would hope that he is dead, but part of the reason I hope that is remembering that his victims are children.
And that many that were confirmed. And then all the other ones, the hundreds that are suspected.
Right. Often poor, often street kids, often in rural areas, not part of mainstream society. That is
right. So again, it's like a population that's sort of at the limits and ignored.
Right. That's sure. where we see this succeeding. So let's look at another case, because that's the other thing, folks. If you haven't seen the video yet, there are numerous cases of uncaught serial killers. We just picked a few.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. We're only talking about like four or five today. Mm-hmm. And I think when we were looking at the general research, there were at least just in a cursory search, like 20, yeah. 30 yeah. uncaught serial killers that are
yes.
pretty widely known.
And the number of missing persons that perhaps aren't even attached yeah. to any known killer are,
yeah.
there are a crazy amount of people that go missing every year.
Right.
Well, for this next one, I chose one from, you know, the neck of the woods that I grew up in, which is, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. I went to school in New Hampshire. This is the Connecticut River Valley serial killer. Connecticut River Valley is this border area between western New Hampshire and Vermont. And this killer basically stalked that area in the 1980s. And six women were killed, stabbed mostly, and their bodies were dumped in the woods near an area called the Sugar River. The time frame for this is much wider than in the previous case that I talked about. So that was one summer. This took place over 10 years. From 1978 to 1988, the first bodies actually turned up in 85, but they believe that he started in 78 based on, you know, like decomposition.
Jeez.
And that they've found at least five of the women by 1987. So the MO of this particular killer was that he would find isolated women. Again, I'm using he as sort of just a general gender term,
okay.
not knowing who it is. But he would find these isolated women, usually hitchhiking or alone at night. Three of the victims were nurses, so they were traveling late night schedules because of their shifts.
Mm-hmm.
He would stab them in the throat and then repeatedly stab them across their bodies, and then took the bodies and dumped them into this particular area in the woods. Sometimes he'd use like a black tarp to sort of like kind of try to hide the bodies a little bit. Okay, so there are several victims leading up to August 6th of 1988, when a woman named Jane Borowski, who was pregnant at the time, mm-hmm. was at a convenience store late at night in the area. The reason, I should probably mention this earlier. One of the reasons why I'm referring to him as a him is because of this particular incident. She identified her attacker as male.
Okay.
He attacked her, stabbed her 23 to 27 times.
God.
And she basically did everything she could to just, you know, kind of protect her baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, to make sure that that area of her body wasn't hit. By playing dead, she was able to survive and basically crawl and then, like, I think walk to the nearest location where I think she knew somebody local and mm-hmm. and get help.
That's incredible.
And I think she might have even driven with that many wounds. So there's a couple things here that are interesting, right? So she survives. So we know that it's a male killer. We know a little bit about how he attacked her.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't take her body like the others, which is curious to me because, you know, like I said earlier, the MO was he stabbed them, then he would take them, bring them to the woods, dump them. But he left her there. So if she was playing dead, was he going to come back later or something? Or maybe it was because of the pregnancy.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Yeah, and how could you ever prove that this is the same guy, right?
Exactly. Right. And in fact, there are four other cases that may be linked, but there's no proof connecting them, right? So again, there's some fascinating leads in this case, but nothing nailed down. No one has ever been apprehended for this.
Okay.
The first lead is a guy named Michael Nicolau, and he was a Vietnam veteran, who actually in 2005 killed his wife and his stepdaughter and then himself in West Tampa, Florida. He had previously been linked to the case by a private investigator who had been looking for his ex-wife, a woman named Michelle Ashley. She basically, in 1988, she disappeared from the Holyoke, Massachusetts area, which is kind of close to that, relatively speaking, close to that Connecticut River Valley area.
Okay.
And so when this private investigator contacted him, he said, oh, well, I don't know where she is, but she ran off with a drug dealer and left me to raise our two kids alone.
Hmm.
Whoa.
So his ex-wife's missing, right? She looks into him, the private investigator, I mean, and she finds out that while he was in the Vietnam War, people who were in his platoon reported that he would go human hunting with a knife. And he would go and basically kill civilians during the war. And she believes that this is connected to this case because there was a military-style association with the way that the victims' necks were cut. So with these stabbing knives, right? So that this was like, again, like, so we were talking earlier about how when you're in a career that sort of puts you in a position in which you're coming into contact with dead bodies, or in this case, you know, killing people,
right?
That, you know, it provides the opportunity to sort of bring about this disorder, if that's what you want to call this type of serial killing. So it's possible, you know, based on this private investigator's theory, that if Nicolau was the one who did it, that he kind of got into this during Vietnam and then brought it back with him to the States afterwards. The thing that is interesting to me is that if his MO was stabbing, remember that when he, you know, had his meltdown in 2005 and killed his family and himself, he did it by shooting them. So, you know, who knows? But it's curious, you know, discrepancy there. However, Jane Borowski, that woman I was talking about earlier, the one who was pregnant and survived, she identified him as the man who attacked her. Now, this is much later, but she looked at, you know, photos of him and after he was gone and said, yeah, that's the guy. So she identified it as Nicolau.
That's pretty strong.
But wait, it gets weirder.
No.
Here's where it gets crazy.
Go for it.
Okay.
All right. Guy named Gary Westover is from the area, and he had been paralyzed from a diving accident. And in 1997, he, at the time, thought he was dying. So he called upon his uncle, who was a former sheriff's deputy in Grafton County, New Hampshire. Again, part of this area.
Mm-hmm. On his supposed deathbed.
Yeah, on his deathbed. And he tells his uncle, he says, okay, a couple of years previous to this, three of my friends picked me up. And they wanted to go partying in a van. And I kind of joked about this with you guys.
Right.
Because, you know, being living in New Hampshire for a long period of time, that's kind of a thing you do. Like you just get into somebody's car or van and, you know, get some drinks.
Some booze.
Some other things. Mm-hmm. Natties and fatties was a common term when I was going to high school up there.
So partying in a van is a thing people do.
I mean,
go somewhere in a van.
It's not unusual. Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't want listeners to think like, oh, that's weird. Like,
just driving around in a van with booze.
Kind of, yeah.
Oh.
let me tell you, I've done it. So, but I haven't done this next part.
Yeah, please, okay.
Please don't associate.
I would hope not.
So Gary Westover says, okay, my friends pick me up. We get into this van. And then they abduct a woman and they killed her and dumped her body off on a back road. And he said, you know, he didn't participate, but that he was forced to be there. And again, remember, he's in a wheelchair. So he basically said, look, I feel really bad about this. I want to tell the truth. I want you to know about this to his uncle. But he had previously been scared to say anything because they said, well, look, you know, we can get you anytime.
That's true.
So if you say anything, we, you know, you're an easy target. And the other thing that's kind of interesting about this is that private investigator who had looked into Nicolau previously also speculated that it's possible that Gary Westover was used as bait for one of these killings.
Oh,
and that because it was particularly snowy, they were in the middle of a snowstorm when this van party was going on, they placed him in his wheelchair. This is her speculation, mind you. There's no evidence for this.
Sure.
But they placed him in his wheelchair on the side of the road so that when one of the women drove by, she pulled over to help him to find out what was wrong, and that's when they killed her.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Calculated.
So the private investigator comes into this again, though, because she says, well, it's possible that that Michael Nicolau guy was one of these three friends. In that it's possible that he and Gary Westover knew each other because they were both veterans and they might have met through the local Veterans Affairs Hospital. And so if that's true and Gary Westover's story is true, and even if Nicolau was the killer, then that means that there's two other guys out there that were accomplices or involved in these murders somehow. And reportedly, you know, police have access to the names. Of course, his uncle took this information forward and became part of the case. But,
sure,
you know, no arrests have been made.
As of our recording today.
Right.
Wow.
So before we get to some statistics, we have one more case, and we'll walk through this one kind of quickly here. This is the Long Island serial killer, an unidentified assailant believed to have killed anywhere from 10 to 17 or more people over the course of 20 plus years around the Ocean Parkway area. Time frame here would be at least 1996 to 2009, 2013. So what kind of victims are we talking about here?
Well, it's kind of similar to a few of the other cases that we've already looked at, where these are primarily sex workers, or at least believed to be sex workers, who were killed at some location, then put into, in this case, a burlap sack, and then dumped along the parkway, and that's particularly at Gilgo Beach in this area.
So that is so similar to the New Bedford Highway guy.
And it's not far.
No, it's not at all. Long Island is not, I mean, like maybe 5 hours at the most. But, I mean, I'm not saying that it's the same guy, but there's also sort of like the idea that this motive, the MO could have been spread through the media. You know, I mean, this 96 was when these started. So this happened like just about, I don't know, 10 years after.
And it continued until almost today. I mean, it's close, right? 2009, 2013.
Well, we don't know when it ended, too.
Well, yeah. So the ones that we know of go that far.
And there were some anomalous things there as well. There was a man, the body of a man and a toddler discovered. So they went into profiling, which, as we know, can be a dangerous game at times. And don't get me wrong, profilers in real life are doing fantastic and vital work.
Oh, yes.
But I think it's also, we talk about this off air, folks. Every so often something comes out about quantum mechanics and you can hear everybody roll their eyes. You can literally hear eyes rolling in their sockets at our office because quantum mechanics, it's one of the most misunderstood things, I think, of popular culture, and profilers would be up in the top 10. What they actually do.
Yeah.
And how they do it. But here's
just a lot of, I think, forensic work.
Oh, yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh, no spoilers, but it's true. So we have this, look from a profiler with all those caveats. The authorities surmise that this killer is a male and is financially comfortable, obviously owns an auto to transport victims, and could have a job where he has access to burlap sacks, maybe a center or nursery. I think it's also possible that he could just be buying them. The big thing is they believe he's familiar with police methods, possibly working in law enforcement or having friends, maybe family members, who do. And they're also – here's another thing. They're also certain that – well, fairly certain that he buried some of these bodies or stored them somewhere before he dumped them, meaning that it's possible, adding on to your earlier statement about New Bedford, it's possible that he is visiting the area seasonally. It gives us some questions, right? Could it be abducting his victims?
Wait, I see a note here that says that these all these victims, or sorry, the first four victims disappeared between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Yes.
That's almost exactly the same as the New Bedford situation.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It was very, it was a summer spree. Well, again, I'm using the term spree wrong.
Sure.
It was a summer serial killer.
So, well, you know, I just want to say another thing that was interesting. A couple of the victims were prostitutes who were advertising on Craigslist, who were advertising their services.
Uh-huh.
So again, that's someone who is perhaps not immediately in the area that could find someone who was in that location and meet up with them through the Craigslist meetup. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is all. Ugh.
That's a good point.
I mean, it's disturbing either way. Like, you know, it's fun to play armchair detective and try to find some kind of connections, but it's also just disturbing in the fact that they're so similar and didn't happen all that far away from one another, and both are still unsolved.
Yeah, and didn't happen that far away from each other, really, in space or time.
Yeah, so right.
And I think that's a very good catch about the timing of the murders. So we do have some leads. There's been a lot of speculation in the media about this identity of this killer. The street name for this killer would be Unsub. Not what you do when you don't like a YouTube channel, but as a portmanteau for unknown subject. And they believe, again, he's most likely a male, specifically a white male. I don't know how they knew that part, in his 20s to 40s, clearly familiar with the South Shore of Long Island. But there's an interesting case by or an interesting article, rather, by a fellow named Dr. Scott Bond, writing for Psychology Today. Bond said he believes the killer may have relocated or become dormant, and we'll talk about dormancy in a second, but he does believe the killer resided in New York City at one point because there was a series of phone calls that the killer made. He made after he abducted and murdered a woman named Melissa Bartholomew. He made seven phone calls using her phone over a six-week period in 2009 to Melissa's sister, and these were taunting her, saying horrible things about the victim, and the phone calls could be traced to roughly the Manhattan area.
That's so close. Yeah, yeah, that's one of those things that if you're in the law enforcement looking to find this guy, you're like, oh my gosh, we almost got him.
And he faded away.
Sorry, this sounds like something like that you would see on like a TV show like The Following or something like that, right?
Exactly.
But this is real, like that this guy killed a woman's sister and then called her repeatedly from her own phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's haunting.
Ugh.
So, yeah, and these are just four examples of the Long Island serial killer is currently one of the, I guess, most recent, right? But that doesn't mean that any of these perpetrators fit the same profile. That doesn't mean that any of them are necessarily deceased. So if you look at what the FBI says about it, they will say that serial killers are among us. There is no set profile. There's an interesting thing that we've talked about off air, I believe, which was the Highway Serial Killing Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI started to map this out. And one thing we talked about in Highway of Tears was that these sorts of murders of, again, people on the fringes of society, right? Prostitutes, drug addicts, hitchhikers. These people are prey. And, when the FBI started mapping this, they found more than 500 cases that they could add to their database. And they started to wonder if there were truckers that were using the opportunity, again, to the excellent point you made earlier, to become serial murderers, and furthermore, if these criminals were hunting in packs, essentially.
Well, I mean, that goes back to the what was it, Gary Westover claim about that four, well, you know, he said that he wasn't actively taking part in it, but three guys were basically driving around in a van together in New Hampshire stalking women.
Right. And it's true that
which is contrary, I'd like to just say this, very contrary to our popularized idea of serial killers,
right,
too,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And there's a conservative estimate that comes from a fellow named John Douglas, a former chief of the FBI's elite serial crime unit and the author of a book called Mindhunter. He says that at his conservative estimate, there are between 35 and 50 active serial killers in the U.S. at any given time. And because they have no profile, because they could be the person you walk past on your way from the gas pump to the cashier, because they could be one of the six people with you in an elevator, because of this.
Shut your mouth.
Anyone.
Shut your mouth. That's horrifying.
Well, it's horrifying. It's a little alarmist too, because if we consider that there are, what, around 330 million people in the U.S.
And then, yeah, right. Maybe 60 to 35 of those.
Yeah, it's a very small percentage.
But he also said it was a conservative estimate. And it makes me think, this is entirely supposition, but it makes me think if these stereotypes about serial killers are impeding apprehending them, because I'm sure even now in living in a surveillance state, I'm sure it'd be quite possible for someone to be, you know, a normal average person. And every 2 years they take a 2 week vacation somewhere they've never been because they like to see the sights. And then a homeless person goes missing that over that same stretch. And then they never go to, you know, Aruba or Vegas again.
So this is a thing that we often run into here at How Stuff Works on all of the shows, really, is I find that the various things that we research here, I end up with this perspective of, well, from our current vantage point here in 2015, we can look back on such and such discovery and go, oh, isn't it so silly that they didn't understand this disease or this biological factor 100 years ago or whatever. I really feel like the more we look into this, that serial killer psychology is something that we don't quite understand that well right now. And that in the future, people are going to look back and say, wow, they're really in the dark about this. And then just making lots of TV shows and movies kind of celebrating it.
Yeah. I
agree. As if they understood it.
There's this glorification in some ways. That's
and don't get me wrong. That's some of my favorite stuff. I mean, like I said earlier, like I'm a huge fan of the Hannibal TV show. You guys know I love the old TV show Millennium with Lance Henriksen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's another, like, serial killer profiler show. But, I mean, it's just bizarre when you think about it, how we sort of approach this thing. I guess it's sort of like our attempt as a culture to understand it and feel safe with it by, binding it to a story.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's also, it gives you a tremendous feeling of relief when the bad guy in one of those gets caught.
Yeah, right.
You know, or almost gets caught, or just, you know, I was watching The Following.
Yeah.
And just all the times we're like, all right, well, that was nice resolution. Oh, no, he's back.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
One thing that I want to bring out to the audience and to everyone else before we get toward the end of the show is this. I almost said The Following, but that would be a poor choice of words. Is this. We know that we live in a world of predictive data, right? Big data. And it is possible now to gain an increasingly sophisticated prognostication, really, of an individual's future actions based on what they're doing. Would it be possible to, I mean, I know I'm proposing this idea of pre-crime, essentially.
You're talking about Minority Report.
I'm talking about something like Minority
That's
Report.
That's kind of already happening now. It's just what you're going to buy in the next six to 12 months.
Yeah.
As I've found out after having a baby.
Really? What happened?
Just depending on what goes on your credit cards, depending on what I happen to purchase at, let's say, Kroger.
Uh-huh.
If I end up using my Kroger Plus card.
What happens?
It tracks all of the information of what I'm buying, and then it sends that information to everybody else. Yeah. Kroger sells that information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So on my television, right before I canceled cable, every ad was diapers or, you know, something like depression medication. I'm not kidding you. It was happening already. It was trying to understand what my life was like.
Depression medication.
Well, yeah, because
that's why Hulu keeps telling me to go to the gym.
I'm completely serious though. It really is trying to target me
as
it does everyone else. And when I say it, I mean big data, essentially.
Well, alright, I got a short story that I gotta tell you guys because this is perfect for your audience. And this is anecdotal, and I'm not gonna name this person. I have a friend who has a PhD in computer science and has done freelance work for the DoD before. And one of the projects that he was assigned to was predictive data, basically trying to map out the probabilities of government employees breaking the rules.
Are you allowed to tell us this?
Based on – he's not allowed to tell you this. I'm allowed to tell you. basically, the idea being that, you know, based on their actions within the network and how they're using, you know, the computer system.
Are they going to go Snowden?
Yeah. Yeah, essentially.
I could see that. I mean, I could see that being a necessary thing from their perspective.
Oh, sure. I understand it completely. But it's possible.
Yeah, it is possible. And often, you know, I'm sure we'll get a lot of letters from people who are saying that often the idea of security is falsely, you know, is marketed in an alarmist fashion to get people to sacrifice privacy. And I think that's absolutely true. But then that leads us to a philosophical quandary, which is directly, do we let 50 people go around killing people on the interstate because we don't want targeted advertising? I know. I'm clearly swaying in that way. this is not the way that I necessarily believe it. I'm just playing devil's advocate. Question.
Bringing it back to Al Pacino.
We're talking off air about, you can probably tell Christian and I are both under the weather, and we were thinking, man, our voices are going to be awesome in this show.
Kevin.
Wait, speaking of awesome, do you guys hear that music? Do you hear? Is that just me? Am I having a stroke?
You know, I kind of felt like I was having a stroke the other day. I got a cavity filled for the very first time, and the whole half of my face was numb, and it was a very strange sensation.
We made it through the fire. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a moment with our super producer, Noel Brown. Noel, I'm not choosing a nickname for this episode because it feels...
You guys went a little dark with it.
It got a little dark. Got a little dark.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't need those kind of nicknames, Ben. I just don't need them. What's on my mind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've still got this little chest cold thing. Everyone's under the weather.
Huh?
It's this crazy seasonal change. I always seem to get hit with something around this time.
Except for Matt.
Yeah, I know. I haven't gotten it yet.
The guy with the baby is the only one who's healthy.
Maybe there's an immune system thing that happens.
Just wait till he starts school.
Oh, yes, and then exposed to all the other elements, the children's elements.
It's bad.
You're sending your kid to school?
You know,
you monster.
I was thinking about it, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Okay, really fast, Noel. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get into this if you don't want to, but I'm really curious. Homeschooling? Is that a thing, Ben? Guys, were you at all, and should we?
It's definitely a thing.
Yeah, I was not, and I'm the wrong person to ask because I don't have kids and probably won't. But
look at you, though. You're so well-adjusted.
Aw, thanks. Know. It's just because I went through the fire.
Exactly.
That's the way I feel, too. Okay.
So I'll give you my perspective just briefly. My daughter is 6 years old. She went to Montessori school from like pre-K age to just now. And she loved it. It was great. I really feel, you know, if anyone doesn't know, Montessori is sort of like all kids of different age groups are all in the same classroom together. And so there's this kind of like leadership involved where like the older kids sort of take the lead and set an example for the younger kids. And it's a great way to socialize kids and make them comfortable around in different situations and around different age groups of kids. Loved it. Worked great. Feel like it outlived its usefulness. I feel like first grade, she needs to be in public school with the rest of the in the fray, you know?
Yeah.
No more soft pedaling everything, and you know, I think it's time to throw her into the fire. And she's doing great. She loves it. She loves it.
So this year she's starting?
This year, first
okay.
year.
Okay. Well, you're gonna have to keep me updated with that. So here's the deal, guys. This is what was going on in my world while I was at home editing the video that's coming out this week and the one that came out last week about serial killers. So
you've got, but see, that's it puts a nice bow on it, though. I try to look at that stuff in a positive way, you know.
Yeah, like, my positive way was, how do I make this kid not a serial killer? Like 100%, you're gonna make this kid the opposite.
I mean, it's like a mix of nature and nurture, right?
Right.
Is that sort of what you guys, the takeaway is?
Yeah.
From a lot of this talk.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I usually think that based on the research Absolutely. For all of these things, yeah.
Yeah, it, just don't lock your kid in the basement with the rats.
Good. Don't have one of those yet.
Mm-mm. It is theoretically possible, not plausible, nor ethical or humane, but it is possible to breed someone who would be genetically predisposed to some sort of serial murdering. But the good news for you is I believe that ship has sailed.
Perhaps.
Kid's already out. You just stay away from them.
I would imagine that would require a significant amount of effort.
I mean, I've never met Matt's parents. Does he have parents? We don't know where Matt came from.
Wait a minute. I met your... Didn't your pops come in here one day?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, that was my dad.
Uh-huh. Are you sure that wasn't a Nazi replicant vampire?
Oh, nice. Good callback.
Real good hair.
Good hair.
So I guess to answer your question, I'm partially homeschooled like every only child is because I hung out with myself a lot.
Like early? You know, okay, never mind.
Yeah,
never mind.
Plead the fifth.
I was homeschooled by He-Man VHS tapes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
At least it wasn't the Masters of the Universe
power,
movie.
As far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
I did have the power.
Nice.
It taught me to believe in myself and yeah. to be a team player because I didn't have any brothers or sisters either.
And talked you out
was
of...
Was that like one of Orko's little lessons at the end of every episode? Yeah.
And talked you out of, or talked you off the ledge of becoming a homicidal maniac, right?
Like Skeletor?
Yeah.
Well, he was the least appealing character in the show. He had
Are
this,
you
like,
kidding
screechy
me?
Little voice. No, he's fun, but he didn't want to be Skeletor.
You identified with Skeletor?
No. Well, okay, certain aspects of it I get. Sure. Like Cobra Commander, you can understand, you know, kind of where they're coming from. But I don't agree with their approach, and I never really understood the mythology of He-Man. I saw the live action film again recently.
Well, that, if anything, just
it just
the
hit
waters.
Netflix.
You shouldn't have done
that. I didn't understand it. And, I didn't understand how something about it not being a cartoon and for a grown, I'll say it. You beat me if you have to, Noel, but for a grown ass Dolph Lundgren to be walking around calling himself He-Man and have other people call him He-Man. I mean, I love nicknames, don't get me wrong, but if I meet somebody who is our age and says, like, they call me, you know, Spin Daddy. Sorry, Derek.
So how did this get made? The comedy podcast that looks at movies actually just did an episode on Masters of the Universe.
Oh, great
and,
podcast.
And they talk about this and they kind of reveal I believe there's one of those like behind the scenes blog posts. Was it like the secrets behind Masters of the Universe talking about how Dolph Lundgren got involved in the movie?
Wow. Yeah.
It makes me think when you think of the name He-Man, like what could be a more absurd masculine name, you know, and I'll tell you what could be but it works because it's a band called Man-Man. And that, to me, that one ups it, but in a great way because they're this kind of weirdo Tom Waitsy kind of like, you know, psychedelic wow. pirate kind of rock band.
Is it hyphenated?
I think it's one
Man-Man.
Rock, Man-Man.
There probably is someone somewhere in the world because there are billions of people here and their name probably is Man-Man. Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't mean the same thing it does to us in English.
Probably not.
How did we get here, guys?
How did we get here?
Well, you know what? After you talk about uncut serial killers for an hour,
you gotta have a little bit of ear bleach.
Yeah.
Talk about He-Man.
Well, guys, we are going to head out. We know this episode went a little bit longer, but that's one of the main complaints we get is that people want longer episodes. So, we hope that I don't know if enjoy is the right word to use for this, but we hope that this sheds some light on some of the misapprehensions people have. And we want to thank Christian Sager for coming in again. If you like this episode, you'll also like the Comics Code episode we did earlier.
Yeah, that was a fun one. And you can also find me on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, where I podcast with our colleagues Robert and Joe about all things weird and sciencey. I guess the one I would recommend the most, that sort of if you liked what we talked about here, is that Science of Necrophilia episode that I mentioned earlier.
But don't discount, there are a lot of episodes you guys have done, especially recently since the three of you have been podcasting that are right, I think, in our listeners' alley.
Oh, yeah. Especially all of October, we've been doing not Halloween-themed, but sort of October-themed topics. So, mm-hmm. for instance, like those guys tackled natural burials. And Robert and I took a look at the psychology of final girls in slasher movies. Mm-hmm. So we've done some interesting stuff like that. Yeah, your audience would certainly be interested, I hope.
Oh, yeah, check it out. If you like stuff they don't want you to know, you'll love stuff to blow your mind. Oh, wait, before we go, there's one more big announcement, which is this was our last moment with Noel.
Oh,
it's okay, guys.
It's terrible.
I knew it was short-lived, you know?
Yeah.
It was nice while it lasted.
Right.
Wait, there's more.
Yes, but hey. Wait, there's more. The reason it's our last moment with Noel in this episode is because from now on, this is going to be a three-person show. So when
three-person plus.
Three-person plus, because when you tune in from every week, and we hope you do, you're going to be hearing Noel and Matt and I, and perhaps some special guests, if I can. I mean, I already have exhausted my podcast karma, maybe cajoling you into this.
But I'm sure I'll come back at some point. There's plenty of more uncaught serial killers for us to discuss.
Right. And
hopefully something more pleasant.
Yeah, let's come up with a happier conspiracy theory.
Okay.
And we've been talking about doing something about the Invisibles. That would be a fun one.
Ah, yes. That's something
done.
A lot of people want to know about the Berenstain Bears and the Mandela Effect. So we'd like to pass this question to you.
And that's the end of this classic episode. If you have any thoughts or questions about this episode, you can get into contact with us in a number of different ways. One of the best is to give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. If you don't want to do that, you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.